the oh so many overseas and imperial wars. Thanks, KABU members, for your generous support. If you are not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate. Coming up on The Boo this morning, still at 11:30, Between the Lines Radio reports on mounting evidence of Trump's obstruction of the Russian probe, plus North American indigenous divestment campaigns targeting pipeline funding banks. And now, you can stay tuned for Intersections Radio, who welcomes to the KABU studio Malian blues guitarist V. Afarka Toure. This program is made possible by KABU members and support from Chamber Music Northwest, featuring the 2017 Summer Festival starting June 26th, 5 weeks of music, over 30 concerts, more than 60 artists and ensembles, 8 world premieres, 2 theatrical experiences, and a celebration of women composers that spans nine centuries. More information at cmnw.org. And by Portland Saturday Market, from our hands to yours, celebrating 44 years of American arts and crafts, freshly prepared foods with an international flavor, and local music every Saturday and Sunday from March through Christmas Eve in Waterfront Park. Local artisans, international food, live music, PortlandSaturdayMarket.com. And now, more music.
You're listening to Intersections Radio, the podcast where we geek out on all things intersectionality. I'm your host, Sarika Mehta. Welcome, and thanks for tuning in. Today is another exciting in-studio episode with a phenomenal musician, Malian blues guitarist V. Afarka Toure. V. was born and raised in Nyafunke, Mali, and is the son of legendary blues guitarist Ali Afarka Toure. And as it were, this family comes from a long line of proud soldiers, with the tradition changing with Via's father. And we're going to talk more about that interesting story in just a bit. V. Afarka Toure's latest album is called Samba, released in April, and was recorded live at Woodstock, New York. You can catch him live in concert tonight at Star Theater here in Portland. And Mali is home to many great blues guitarists and really extraordinary music, generally speaking. But I am so thrilled to have one of the blues guitar virtuosos here chatting with me for Intersections Radio. And V. brought his guitar along, so we are in for a treat. And by the way, we are streaming live on Facebook, and this is an Intersections Radio first, so also a brave new world for me. You can see us live right now and check out the archive later at facebook.com/KABU Radio. So, V. Afarka Toure, welcome to Intersections Radio.
Thank you. I'm really happy to be with you here.
Let's start with talking about your family and where you grew up in Mali.
Yeah, it's actually like 1 hour drive from Timbuktu now. Yeah, before it's like 6 hour maybe, because you don't have like road.
Some roads are built.
Yeah, but now they build the road. It's good. It's no problem. So you can just take 1 hour and 1 hour off here in Nyafunke from Timbuktu, actually.
And as I mentioned in the introduction, you know, your family had this tradition of being soldiers, and then your father defied this tradition and became a musician.
Yeah.
And you also wanted to become a musician, but he was not so keen on this idea.
You know, the problem is not just jump in the stage and play and give the people fun. It's not for this.
Right.
But it's also when he started, you know, like in 18 to be like an international artist, he have many problems. So it's so many people bring him, you know, in Europe, in somewhere, they didn't give him like a good pay. If you bring something for like 1,000 or 2,000 and you give her 200, that's not good.
Right.
Yeah. So he doing a lot of like this because he don't read. And it's, you know, my father never go to school.
Sure.
Yeah. But he's speaking French. He's speaking like, but he never go to school. So when they give him like the contract, they just said, no, sign here. He don't know what he's
signing. He doesn't understand the contract.
He just sign it. So this why he asked me, say, okay. And also, you know, the music is very difficult. So you have to have big power.
Which big part energy. Is difficult?
The difficult is, you know, you have to work all the time. You are not on your family. You are always in the world. So you say, okay, maybe it's better to be soldiers. Because, you know, the music, it's not everybody have a chance to go to United States, right. Europe, everywhere. But if you're soldiers, so you can just have your pay. But maybe you're going to die in 2 or 3 months. So it's like this, you know. So for me, it's good if I say, okay, musician or soldiers, for me, it's the same. We protect the people. It's like protection. We give fun, you know, we let people like happy, you know, it's like this.
It's a different kind of service to your country.
Yeah.
That's incredible. Well, from what I understand, he didn't want you to follow the music tradition because of what you were just talking about, all of the difficulties that he faced.
Yeah.
And so you follow it secretly.
Yeah. When I'm starting, I'm going to go to, you know, I'm playing just me. I take a little bit of radio, you know. Mm-hmm. They have a cassette on this time. It's not a CD. And, you know, I'm keep be with him, you know, to give him, goodbye, Papa, you have to let me do my music. You know, I love the music. I don't like to be soldiers. You know, my father's not somebody like very strong, you know. He's strong because he need you to do something, mm-hmm. but he's very good father. He's not like saying no. If you come to him, you say, oh, please, and he lets you do what you want.
When did he give you his blessing to pursue music?
You know, when Eric's my producer, yeah, now he's my manager.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Modiba Production. So when we're starting, like when he came in 2003 to take some lessons, you know, in Mali, he see me. So when I'm starting, you know, I'm starting to maybe in 2001 to learn guitar.
Only in 2001?
Yeah, but I'm, doing it
2001. Well, okay.
Yeah, but I'm starting music. Actually, I'm drummer. From 94, something like this, you know.
How old were you when you started learning music?
Wow, I don't know, maybe.
I mean, I know you were around it your whole life, but
like
when you
music,
started...
Music is 2001. So I'm like 20...
So you started drums when you were 13 and only in 2001, which is now 16 years ago.
Yeah.
Which, when we're talking about the level of fame and expertise that you develop in music, that's not very long.
It's not very long, but you know, the music is what I tell the people all the time. Some people stay, you know, learn 20 years, they are musician for 25 or 30 years, but they didn't get chance, you know, to have this. Because I think it's just because they don't have chance, but it's also, I think the music doesn't choose them. You don't choose the music, say, okay, I want to be a musician.
Mm-hmm.
The music can choose you to say, okay, I have you to be a musician. I need to be a musician.
Well, tell me about that experience when the music chose you.
You know, when I go to school, I go like drummer in Institute of Arts.
Mm-hmm.
So when we do the concours? Yeah, the audition to being like to come in the mm-hmm. the Institute of Arts.
Mm-hmm.
I have one of my professor. He say, wow, you're a good drummer, but you don't have to. What are you gonna learn here? It's, you know, you're a drummer, so you finish. So you have to choose another instrument.
Oh, you'd already surpassed what they could teach you.
Yeah.
I see. Okay.
I say okay. So now you have to choose another instrument. Why not guitar? Your father play guitar very well, so we have to choose guitar and we can see. I say, okay, maybe, why not? So he said, how I just take guitar? You know, I'm starting to learn. It's coming to me like it's very, very easy to learn something. If you play something, I'm going to play now. And also my professor say, wow, I didn't even see guys like you. You know, all the students here, when they first learn, it's taking 2 years to play one song correctly.
Mm-hmm.
But you and month, you play all the song I give you. You say, okay, that's good. So I keep be with him, you know. His name Antoine. He's in the SU, but now he's, yeah. So I stopped to play drums, calabash, everything. So continue with the guitar. But I don't know why, how, you know, sometimes the people asking me, how you play? I don't know. It's just come like this. So
because the music chose you.
Yeah.
That's really amazing. That's incredible. Yeah. Well, let's talk about your latest album, Samba. The name, it indicates your place in your family.
Yes. So the name
talk
is,
about that.
You know, I'm Samba because I'm the second boy from family, in my family.
How many siblings are there?
We are 12.
You're 12.
Yeah, so I'm the second. The second boy. I have a big, you know, sisters and, you know, but I'm second boy.
It's an important position.
It's very important position in my family. So all the second boy, they say they're gonna be someone someday. Mm-hmm. Everybody gonna talk to them, you know, say, you are.
They're going to become somebody.
Yeah,
but they don't say this about the first son.
What? The first.
You're saying that they say this about the second son.
The second son. No, the first son.
But they don't say this about the first one.
No, they didn't say. Yeah, they didn't say anything for the first son. The first son, they say they must good. They like responsible.
They need to.
It's just like the second boy.
This is very interesting. Yeah. I didn't know this.
Okay.
I've never heard of a story where there's a special consideration for the second son. It's always the first one.
Yeah.
And yes, always the son, let's just be honest about it.
Yeah, the first, they say Hamadi. Hamadi. First boy. So the second is Samba. So maybe sometimes they say, okay, the Samba is like the shushu for the family.
The very loved one.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. Okay. Well, this album was recorded in front of an audience. Tell us about the album and why did you decide to do this style, this live recording?
Actually, it's not me, but I think it's Eric, my manager. So it's 2 years. He's starting to tell me, okay, I know what you put in energy you have in the stage. I would like you to put this energy in the city, share with the people. So, and also when we do the live album, the people love it, and everybody say, okay, so let's do that. So he asked me, you think it's maybe the next album you're gonna do some live? I say yes, why not? Sometimes with the live album is very difficult because the people don't like, because after you have to put any, like, it's difficult, you know, to be like to do like a live album. So for me, I think it's fine. Just after the tour, we're touring here for like 1 month. Okay, we say let's go to Tsijo. So we go there and 2 days, it's finished.
Wow.
Yeah, we finish the album in 2 days. So they stay there for mixing everything.
That's incredible.
Yeah, but it's like, you know, when you see the people for the first, my drummer say, wow, we have some people there, so they're going to be very difficult. I say, this is a good one because you have to feel, you have to feel the people. So you have to feel what you're doing like you are on the stage. So do what you want, play how you want, you're good.
You have your guitar, and I know that whoever is watching on Facebook is dying, as I am, to hear your music. I was going to request either Mariam or Sambasi Kairi. But I will leave it to you. What would you like to play?
We're going to play Sambasi Kairi, I think. Let's meet.
That sounds good. Let's hear it.
Mashallah. Samba se kaira si amba se jurme, ay me ti samba.
Ambazi kaira si ambazi jurme, ay me ti samba. Morgasi hambur mo ti samba, ay mo ti samba. Morgasi hambur mo ti samba.
That was beautiful. Thank you.
Yeah. So now it's talking about, you know, the samba. They don't care. They don't like, they have like big power. Yes. It's like, samba is like the number one.
It's you. Yeah. Well, tell me about producing the songs in this, or composing the songs for this album. What went into this?
You know, it's a some song in this album I composed a very long time. Like my grandfather's Afo Adu, you know, they used to play me this song. Not to play, but they sing the song, and they give me like a calabash and a big hat, you know, big hat. And they sound like samba zikaria.
Because you are samba.
Yeah. And they you know, they used to sing with this. So it's a very long time. Also, you have some, you know, you have some like a homofuwawa. It's like maybe 3 years or 4 years and still play this homofuwawa. I wanna do some album now, but I have some when I'm working an album, if I have like one songs, I wanna say, okay, this song's don't have to be with this album, so I want to put this song for after, you know,
we have save
some,
for later.
Yeah, we have some song, like we have some song, you know, we already record this song, but it's not come out. Maybe this song is not going in this album, you wait for another one.
I see. And how or why do you decide for which songs go in which album?
It's different, the style, because they have some song like Mon Pays. It's a very acoustic, used with calabash, everything. In The Secret, it's like I'm doing this album with John Scofield, you know, Eric Krasnow.
Many collaborators.
Yeah, many collaborations.
Yeah, we're on that album.
So every album have one specialty.
I see.
This album, like Samba, is just me.
You are the specialty.
Yeah. So I think we don't have any guests. Artists and this album, it's just me
and recorded live.
Yeah
That's exciting.
So every album's coming with something very special. Some song, it's good to have like the people, like somebody invite somebody to be on this album. And sometime I would like to give the song some, I want just to play the music, but I want to give the song somebody to sing, because I don't give the lyrics, but what I like, I'm not allowed to do that. So I'm going to give it to somebody to do that.
So do you mean when you're writing this lyrics, yeah, or you want somebody else to sing?
No. I write the lyrics and I give somebody else to sing. Sometimes, Nina Gaba is in this album. Mm-hmm. I don't would like to put solo. Say, okay, maybe I want to take somebody. I take Nguni player. I say, okay, you have to do the solo. I don't have to do solo on this one. So it's like how I'm feeling. I'm just to follow the music, how, you know, what do you say? One rule, you know, you have to follow, just yes, and you go.
That's, I like that. You're offering these songs to other people, or the solos to others as well. That's
so they sing, or the music, or the stuff, or they sing, or they play solos, mm-hmm, or they, you know. And sometimes with the mixage, when we mix it, all the time I'm doing all the, you know, I'm here, so do this. But sometimes I say, okay, I'm not doing anything. For the arrangement, for everything, you guys have to do that. It's like the Mopei I sent to England to do the mastering and mixage there.
So for your album Mopei, you sent it to somebody else to do the production?
Yeah,
sure.
My father's, used to be my father's record label.
Oh, wow.
I send them, I say, okay, for this is very acoustic, you guys very good for the acoustic, because I know how to work with my father. So you have to do that.
Changing topic entirely.
Yeah.
I want to talk a little bit about Mali.
Yeah.
What is it like for you? You perform in the United States, you perform all over the world, in Europe, and what is it like for you to perform in Mali for your people?
Oof. You know, the Mali is a country, it's very like weird for the musician. This is not another, like, I think the Malian people, just are the Muslim people, don't be exactly what the musician. They listen, but it's like when I come to last night in we do most and sold out in Seattle, but it's just only 2 Malians.
Oh.
When I'm touring, no Malian.
Right.
When I'm playing Mali, no Malian. You know the Malian, they love, we have another kind of music, they say the griot. Like Tumani Jabate, Babani Kone, all this griot.
Mm-hmm.
So when they sing, they come to you, they say, ah, your father's good, your mother's good, and you give money. Like, you know, they love this kind of music. But we are not this kind of artist. When I'm just here to doing music, to send some message, to educate the people, this is my job. The Malians, they're not very, very interested. Some, the people interested, they are there, but it's not. When we say the Malian, it's the younger, you know, the younger
generation.
No, I don't have this younger generation. When I play somewhere in Mali, all these just white people.
Oh.
Yeah, French, Spain, United States, they're coming. Well, after the show pass, they just, why? We didn't know you play. We have to come see you.
Oh, no.
How? So they are like this. You say, okay. I know. No problem. It's fine. But it's always sold out when I play. Or they come after the show. Because when the Malians say we start the show at 10, they start at 1 o'clock. So, I'm Artist International. I'm playing everywhere. When I say I'm starting my show at 10, at 10 I'm starting. And 12:30 I'm stop. It's like this. So when you stop, you go out, it's when they come in. You see them, you know, like this. Oh, why you start telling me? But we think, you know, you're gonna, you know, it's like a Malian hour. I say, no, this is European hour. You have to be,
you know, my like, culture has this, many cultures have this problem.
So, you have this
problem resource, whatever we want to call it.
So this is why I never see them there. It's not because they don't like my music. They love my music. They, you know, they you know, somebody, sometimes the people just come to me, oh, you are my best musician, you know. But
they're just late.
Yeah, always late. And when they play, when the people promote me to play somewhere, it's very expensive to see me.
That's kind of an awkward situation to be in, and I can understand
that. Yeah, it's really difficult there, you know. It's a Mali. Africa is always like, you know.
Yeah.
But I love the people from like Senegal, Côte d'Ivoire, Ivory Coast, if their artists play, they are here. But not the Malian people.
We are just about out of time. Would you like to do an instrumental or?
Yeah, it's not a problem.
Yeah, okay. Which one is this one that you're going to play?
Bonheur.
Thank you so much for joining me on Intersections Radio.
Thank you. Thank you. We're very happy to be here with you.
That was my guest, Malian blues artist Viafar Katuré. His new album is Samba, and you can see him live in concert tonight at Star Theater in Portland for those who are tuning in via Facebook. This interview was recorded at KBOO Community Radio and live streamed on Facebook, which, as I mentioned, was a first for Intersections Radio. You can check out the archive at facebook.com/KBOO Radio. To listen to a podcast of this interview, check out intersectionsradio.wordpress.com, visit the website for previous episodes of this podcast, and join the Facebook community at facebook.com/intersectionsradio. You're listening to Intersections Radio. This program airs locally on KBOO Community Radio. I'm Sarika Mehta. Thanks for listening.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Vanport Mosaic Festival, May 26th through the 29th, at various locations throughout North and Northeast Portland. The second annual Vanport Mosaic Festival will offer an exploration of the history and legacy of Vanport through a series of films and plays, lectures and conversations, and guided tours. Audiences will be invited to reflect upon the journeys of those who lived and died in the city of Vanport. As part of the festival, there will be screenings of a selection of Vanport oral histories. Again, that's the Vanport Mosaic Festival, May 26th through the 29th, at various locations throughout North and Northeast Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Marjorie Cohn, past president of the National Lawyers Guild and legal scholar, who examines the mounting evidence indicating that President Trump may be guilty of obstructing justice. Kathy Kelly of the group Voices for Creative Nonviolence, who assesses the death and destruction in Yemen's forgotten civil war, exacerbated by Saudi intervention in U.S. arms. And Matt Remley, a member of the Lakota Nation, who discusses the grassroots indigenous campaign targeting banks funding the Dakota Access Pipeline and four other tar sands crude oil pipelines originating in Alberta, Canada. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Outrage exploded over the murder of award-winning Mexican journalist Javier Valdez, only a block from his newspaper office. Rio Doce, and was a vocal critic of the drug cartels and their persistent targeting of Mexican journalists. In 2011, he won the Committee to Protect Journalists Press Freedom Award. The New York-based group had recently met with Mexican President Enrique Peña Nieto, seeking protections for journalists covering Mexico's drug war. After the murder, two Mexican news outlets, Animal Político and Tercera Vía, suspended publication for one day. Before he was killed, Valdez told the press freedom group Index on Censorship that a grenade had been thrown into his office in 2009, and he'd received numerous death threats from the drug cartels. The crusading journalist insisted that sources have been killed or disappeared, and the government doesn't care and does nothing to protect them. According to the Committee to Protect Journalists, over 50 reporters have been killed or disappeared in Mexico since 2010. U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement agents have arrested over 41,000 suspects since President Trump signed an executive order in late January, expanding the power of ICE agents to deport migrants. Acting Director of ICE Thomas Homan declared there are no enforcement limits protecting undocumented migrants. The Trump executive order not only allows ICE agents to arrest those convicted of a crime, but also residents suspected of having committed a chargeable criminal offense. According to the Los Angeles Times, more than 8 million U.S. residents are now classified by the government as high priority for deportation, more than four times the number in that status under the Obama administration. The surge in ICE arrests comes as Trump's high-profile border wall with Mexico has stalled in Congress and the Muslim travel ban is tied up in federal courts. According to ICE's own data, 10,000 immigrants have been arrested for simply entering the United States illegally, more than double the number charged for this offense 1 year ago. Many police departments have refused to allow ICE agents to enter local jails, asserting that their policy would seriously damage relations with local immigrant communities. As a result, ICE is now engaged in more aggressive street patrols at courthouses and schools. In 2012, arch-conservative governor of Kansas, Sam Brownback, instituted tax cuts designed by supply-side guru Arthur Laffer that were supposed to pay for themselves. But the tax cuts, similar to those proposed by President Trump, forced deep cuts in the state's basic services. Deficits have now jeopardized the viability of the Kansas public school system, resulting in a $500 million shortfall this year. A key element of the Brownback tax cut plan was to slash taxes paid by limited liability corporations and pass-through businesses. Many independent businesses now pay no state taxes. The false hope was that the businesses would invest their tax savings in creating new jobs, but job creation in Kansas today lags behind neighboring states. Former Kansas Secretary of Administration Dwayne Goosen told The Guardian there is no evidence whatsoever that suggests this plan works. The Kansas Supreme Court has ruled that the state has underfunded schools by hundreds of millions of dollars annually. Class sizes have increased. Teachers have not been replaced, and arts and music programs have been eliminated. Parents who moved to Kansas for their once excellent schools now complain about the chronic education cuts and deteriorating quality. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Leslie Rudden.
As Donald Trump embarked on his first overseas trip as president, new bombshell revelations deepened his administration's escalating crisis. While some Republican legislators welcomed the news that Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein had appointed former FBI Director Robert Mueller as special counsel to investigate charges of collusion between the Trump campaign and Russia's attempt to influence the outcome of the 2016 U.S. presidential election, a hoped-for period of calm never arrived. The Washington Post reported on May 22nd that President Trump had asked Director of National Intelligence Daniel Coats and Admiral Michael Rogers, Director of the National Security Agency, to publicly deny the existence of any evidence of coordination between Trump's campaign and Moscow during the 2016 election. This news on top of earlier revelations that President Trump had urged former FBI Director James Comey to pledge his loyalty and to end his investigation of Trump's fired National Security Advisor Mike Flynn confirms a pattern of behavior consistent with a president attempting to obstruct justice. Evidence of an apparent White House cover-up was amplified in an earlier New York Times story that reported Trump had told Russian officials in a May 10th Oval Office meeting that his dismissal of FBI Director James Comey had relieved great pressure on him, describing Comey as crazy, a real nutjob. Your reporter spoke with Marjorie Cohn, past president of the National Lawyers Guild and legal scholar, who examines the mounting evidence indicating that President Trump may be guilty of obstructing justice in the Russia probe, an impeachable offense.
By appointing Mueller, Rosenstein has given political cover to the Republicans, many of whom are very upset about what's happening with Trump, but are worried that if they distance themselves from him too much, that might impact their chances in the midterm elections in 2018. The problem is that Robert Mueller can be fired by Rosenstein if Trump orders Rosenstein to fire him, because he serves at the pleasure of the executive branch, because we don't have the independent counsel statute where three judges appointed the special counsel. So the charge that Mueller has is to investigate any links between the Russian government and the campaign of Donald Trump, and any matters that arose or may arise directly from the investigation. And that includes an alleged cover-up. So at this point, there is circumstantial evidence of improper conduct between members of the Trump administration and Russian operatives during the presidential campaign, but we have seen no concrete proof of criminal conduct. But the evidence of a cover-up continues to mount. Trump has admitted that the Russia investigation motivated him to fire FBI Director James Comey. Trump asked Comey to end the investigation of former National Security Advisor Michael Flynn. Trump made veiled threats to Comey about possible tapes of their conversations. Trump demanded that Comey pledge loyalty to him, but Comey refused. And Trump defensively fixated on Comey, telling him three times that Trump was not an object of the investigation. Now, two more possible indications of cover-up came out. Turns out that in March, Trump asked the Director of National Intelligence, Coates, and the Director of the NSA, Rogers, to deny any collusion between Russia and the Trump administration, and both refused. So these two developments also add to the case for obstruction of justice. And obstruction of justice is basically requires that a person corruptly or by use of threats obstructs, impedes, or endeavors to influence, obstruct, or impede a congressional investigation, a criminal investigation, an investigation by a department or agency of the U.S., or a federal court proceeding. But in order to be found guilty of obstruction of justice, a person has to act with an improper purpose. That's the corruptly part of the statute. And before Trump asked Comey to drop the investigation of Flynn, he was in the Oval Office. The two of them were in the Oval Office with Vice President Pence and Attorney General Sessions, and Trump asked Pence and Sessions to step out of the Oval Office before Trump asked Comey to drop the investigation of Flynn. That could be evidence of an improper purpose.
Many comparisons to Watergate have been made with the recent revelations about Trump's alleged obstruction of justice and a lot of the other scandals plaguing his administration. But certainly a big difference is that we have a one-party state now. Both houses of Congress are run by Republicans, the party of Trump, as is the Supreme Court. They have a working majority on the Supreme Court now, the Republicans do. So if The Republican House of Representatives doesn't initiate impeachment proceedings, and the country at large feels strongly that that should be the course of action. What is the recourse of citizens? Militant protest? Are we talking about a constitutional crisis if Republicans refuse to follow the Constitution and initiate proceedings to prosecute high crimes and misdemeanors?
Well, I think that the same way that constituents of Republican congresspersons packed their offices, packed their town halls, protested, will be done if Congress does not do what people think it should do. And again, in 2018, these Congress people are up for re-election, and they're going to have to answer to their constituents. So even though, yes, the House is controlled by the Republicans, that does not mean necessarily that they're not going to react to demands from their constituents to pursue this, just because they control the House. Now, I don't know that he would actually, even if he was impeached in the House of Representatives, that he would actually be convicted in the Senate by a two-thirds. I think that that's more of a long shot, but, you know, there are some Senate seats open as well, or up for grabs, I should say, as well in 2018. We don't know what's going to happen, and Trump is going to fight it tooth and nail if he doesn't melt down before. You know, it's very, very hard to predict what's going to happen, but I guess you could say it's as fascinating as it is frightening.
That was Marjorie Cohn, past president of the National Lawyers Guild and legal scholar. Her book, Drones and Targeted Killings, will be published in a second edition at the end of May. Find more commentary and analysis on the scandal surrounding Donald Trump's presidency by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. As the civil war in the impoverished nation of Yemen entered its third year in March, few Americans are aware of the death and destruction falling heavily on civilians and their own nation's involvement in the conflict. The combatants engaged in the war are the Houthis, an armed group whose members belong to a branch of Shia Islam known as Zaydism. The Houthis are allied with supporters of Yemen's former dictator, Ali Abdullah Saleh, and are alleged to be receiving arms from Iran. On the other side are forces allied with the current president, Mansour Hadi, supported by a Saudi Arabian-led coalition. According to the UN, nearly 5,000 civilians have died, and more than 8,000 have been wounded since the conflict began, the majority killed by Saudi-led airstrikes. Combatants blocking critical food supplies threatens famine, and an outbreak of cholera that has spread to more than 30,000, is expected to deepen Yemen's humanitarian crisis. International human rights groups maintain that horrific abuses and war crimes are being committed throughout Yemen, including Saudi airstrikes that have unlawfully targeted schools, hospitals, homes, markets, and mosques. The human rights community has condemned the arms deal President Trump recently signed with the Saudi monarchy, worth $110 billion. Your reporter spoke with Kathy Kelly, co-coordinator of the group Voices for Creative Nonviolence, who discusses the death and destruction in Yemen's forgotten civil war, exacerbated by Saudi intervention and U.S. arms.
Some people who were aware of our efforts to go to Iraq and bring food and medicines, mostly medicines, to Iraqi children and families when Iraq was under economic sanctions, have been helping us better understand what's happening now in Yemen, where the country is experiencing a naval blockade while they have been so dependent on food in particular that would come through the port of Hodeidah. And now, when they've experienced so many bombings, indiscriminate bombings of hospitals and clinics, as the Saudis have used United States weapons sold during 2015 to the Saudis to attack hospitals, roadways, including, you know, buses that are on roadways, and civilian gatherings, including weddings. And, you know, they've undergone so much terror and fear already in Yemen, and now they're facing starvation and an outbreak of cholera and a very likely imminent bombing of their major port city of Hodeidah. So people who knew what we were doing in Iraq have said, you know, maybe we can help you to now focus on what's happening in Yemen, because it's a place that is so very, very forgotten. President Trump was in Saudi Arabia negotiating a deal with the Saudis such that the Saudis would invest maybe as much as $40 billion or more in United States infrastructure, and people in the United States would get jobs if they're working for weapon makers, and the United States would give $100 billion of weapons to Saudi Arabia, and then the Saudis said, and we're going to try to help stop terrorist attacks. But it's such a conundrum, because really the Saudis have been supporting people who've been waging terrifying attacks in the neighboring country of Yemen. And also, they're teamed up with the Al-Qaeda in the Arab Peninsula, and supplying groups with more weapons is somehow going to lessen terror, and enabling aerial terrorist attacks would somehow bring peace. It's just so unthinkable.
Kathy, we only have about a minute or two left, but I would ask you to briefly provide our listeners with some ideas of what they can do here in the United States to get some attention on the conflict in Yemen, the U.S. role in that conflict, and what we as people could advocate for stopping the carnage.
Well, Connecticut Senator Chris Murphy, who has repeatedly, and at some risk, I would imagine, to his own political future, spoken out about Yemen and about Saudi Arabia, and he has managed to get 27 co-signers to Senate Joint Resolution 40. And that's a resolution that says that weapons cannot be sent to Saudi Arabia while Saudis continue to indiscriminately bomb Yemen and to abuse human rights of people in other countries, but violating international laws. So Senator Murphy, I think, would welcome more support. People can certainly tell their friends and relatives in other states to support Resolution 40, and then also get every single congressperson on board to be part of introducing a similar bill into the Congress, and also joining 55 congresspeople who've said that the United States can't continue to be complicit with the Saudi war without going to Congress and getting authorization. I'm not so sanguine about that one, because I'm afraid with the current makeup of our Congress and Senate, they might get that authorization. So we should say to ourselves as individuals, we won't authorize war. We'll do everything we can to resist it. And of course, education, education, education. These realities that people are experiencing in Yemen, this alarming outbreak of cholera, the bombing of the port city, the indiscriminate bombing of civilian areas, all of this should be part of our mainstream news coverage. And I think with Senator Chris Murphy speaking as eloquently and clearly as he has in Connecticut, you have a chance to push this word out further and further into every possible kind of media. It's interesting that Iran is so vilified, but they did just elect someone who's not a hardliner. Rouhani is a moderate, and he was just elected, and he's now being told, well, you're going to be shut out because you're Shia, and we believe that somehow your country is responsible for terrorism in the world. But I think that doesn't cohere with the truth. You can't even find pictures or intercepts of phone calls that would give evidence that the Iranians have been arming the Houthi rebels. I mean, I'm not saying that they haven't, but there isn't the evidence, and there's so much evidence of the tens of billions and now soon to be hundreds of billions of dollars of weapons that the United States has sold to Saudi Arabia.
That was Kathy Kelly, co-coordinator of the group Voices for Creative Nonviolence. For more analysis on the war in Yemen and the U.S. and Saudi role in the conflict, visit our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Earlier this month, a coalition of grassroots indigenous groups from across North America, what they call Turtle Island, joined with more than 100 indigenous nations and tribes in Canada that are members of the Treaty Alliance Against Tar Sands Expansion to launch a new integrated divestment campaign. Their targets are the banks funding the Dakota Access Pipeline and four other tar sands crude oil pipelines currently proposed to run from Alberta, Canada, to other regions in Canada and to the U.S. The targeted pipelines include the Keystone XL pipeline, which was killed by former President Obama but revived by Donald Trump. The campaign grew out of earlier organizing against the Keystone XL and the successful campaign in Seattle to force the city to divest from Wells Fargo Bank, a large investor in the Dakota Access Pipeline, other oil pipelines, and socially destructive investments such as private prisons. Thus far, the revived KXL pipeline has not secured any project-level loans. Under Indigenous leadership, other groups, including Rainforest Action Network and a Canadian affiliate of 350.org, are also supporting the multi-pronged effort. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Matt Remley, a member of the Lakota Nation living in Seattle, who worked on the successful City Council divestment resolution and a second resolution that passed prohibiting banks that finance tar sands pipelines from bidding on City of Seattle contracts. Remley, who is a founder and editor of Last Real Indians, an online news site, talks about applying the lessons of previous struggles to this new divestment campaign.
One of our strategies with Wells Fargo and the divestment campaign we ran there was kind of twofold. One, the campaign was never about just stopping with the City of Seattle, but expanding. We wanted to expand to other cities and tribes in terms of getting them to also do divestment efforts. So we worked early on with organizers in San Francisco, LA, and other places around the country and internationally to run similar divestment campaigns. So that was one part of the strategy. The second part, as you know, when Trump issued his executive order, it gave the green light again for the Keystone XL pipeline. So we wanted to be proactive, and we crafted another piece of legislation resolution to take back to the Seattle City Council that said if any bank gives money to TransCanada, project level loans to TransCanada to build the Keystone XL pipeline or any of these other tar sands pipelines, then they would be excluded from bidding on City of Seattle contracts. And that resolution was passed, and that it expanded out to the other tar sands pipelines as well. And then we linked up with some other organizations, including Indigenous Environmental Network, Honor the Earth, the International Indigenous Youth Council, and decided to kind of make it a joint effort, which includes tribal communities located in and around the tar sands, make a global effort to get a lot of places to run divestment campaigns against those pipelines.
Matt Remley, often when groups start a boycott of soft drinks or cigarettes or whatever, the common wisdom is that you target one, usually the industry leader, and go after them, because if you're spread too thin, you're less likely to have success with any of them. What do you think about that argument as it relates to your coalition going after all these banks?
Actually, I would disagree. I mean, and then also, I mean, a boycott's different than a, you know, a divestment campaign in the sense, especially when you're looking at the financial institutions. So, you know, this is something we thought about real strategically when we crafted our ordinance in Seattle to divest from Wells Fargo. So to us, you know, Wells Fargo was one of the main banks behind DAPL, and they had a number of City of Seattle contracts. What we didn't want to see happen was for the City of Seattle to divest its $3 billion in Wells Fargo and then reinvest in a Bank of America or whomever, because that in itself wouldn't be a victory, because all the banks are, you know, got their hands dirty or involvement in some of these pipelines. So when we crafted our ordinance, we were very conscious of that. What we crafted in legislation were this whole set of criteria that we call socially responsible banking practices that includes things like banks not being engaged in predatory lending practices, not invested in energy-intensive fossil fuel projects or private prisons. So what that means is when a bank bids on a City of Seattle contract, they're scored, and there's points associated with it. So banks will be dinged, you know, if they are investing in private prisons or, you know, fossil fuel projects, they're going to be dinged, therefore less likely to be able to bid on City of Seattle contracts. We strengthened that by passing that next resolution, which excludes any bank from bidding on City of Seattle contracts if they are to give project-level loans or investment into any of these TARSAC campaigns.
That was Matt Remley with the campaign to defund proposed tar sands pipelines originating in Alberta, Canada. Learn more about this new divestment campaign by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and streaming audio, and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on CKDU in Halifax, Nova Scotia, KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, KOWA in Olympia, Washington, and more than 50 other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Leslie Rudden, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.